Session number 12394, Jim Gilbert, Reel 1.
So this is Jim Gilbert, Reel 1. So if I could ask you then, Jim, you know, first of all about your background, where you were born, brought up, and the sort of childhood you had.
I was born in St. Louis, in the city. I was the oldest child, and I was raised in my father was an alcoholic, and most of my relatives on his side of the family were alcoholic. I was raised in an abusive environment. My father was violent. I was also sexually abused as a child, not by either of my parents. And I am also a recovering alcoholic. I started drinking at the age of 6. And that was part of the denial in the household. The alcohol was available. And so I guess probably from my point of view, one of the most important experiences that I can think back of two different events that I think might be important. One is my third birthday. I remember my father coming home and he gave me a toy, and I can't really remember the toy per se, but I remember it was red. And later in the day, I had done something that angered him, misbehaving some way. You know, three-year-olds do that. And he came in and he broke my toy. And I remember a rush just kind of going through me, and I knew that I would never allow him to do that to me again. And as time went on, when I would do something and I knew that he was going to be angry, I would break my toys. And I wound up getting sent to a psychiatrist for that, because externally you look at this crazy kid, he's breaking his toys and acting out, and there's something radically wrong. I've come to understand that as the only way I could take any control over my destiny, and that I was exerting the only power that as a three-year-old I could. And that objectively it looked pretty unhealthy. Subjectively, it was probably the healthiest response I could come up with. Of course, the residual was I knew that going to a psychiatrist was not testimony to my good health, and so it reinforced a lot of the knowledge by this time that I was deficient. The other, I guess, awareness or conclusion, and it was about the same time, is that I knew, as we all do, that my parents were the greatest people on earth. You know, my dad's better than yours, and we all, when we're young, we see our parents as being the two people closest to God that we can imagine. And somehow, and I don't know how I knew this, but I did, I knew parents had to love their children. I also knew that if my parents loved me, they wouldn't have treated me the way I was treated. So since they're good, I must be so bad that I'm unlovable. You see, to have been so objectionable that they just simply couldn't, even with their goodness. And so I knew that I was fundamentally flawed. And I also knew that if people didn't get too close to me and know me intimately, that I could have friends. I carried this with me through school. So I was a relatively aloof child. And I was never quite sure what this defect or flaw was, but it was clearly there. I just couldn't figure out what, but I also knew that I didn't want to run the risk of other people finding it because of the whatever the outcomes would be, they would be bad and I would be unhappy. And so I spent an awful lot of my life trying to be the person that I thought you needed me to be for you to like me. And I spent a lot of that time not honoring my own wants and needs and always subordinating my values to what I thought others expected of me. And in a very real sense, that supported my decision to go to the seminary. I look at how this unfolds now, and it was just bizarre. But then, so was my life, you see. And when I was in kindergarten, which is before first grade, here I don't know if you have kindergarten in England, but I remember one morning the teacher passed out these sheets, and there were 20 maybe caricatures of people of different occupations. Nurse, doctor, cowboy, fireman, priest. And I, for some reason, was drawn to the priest. And as coincidence may have it, the pastor of the parish school where I was attending visited our classroom that morning, and it was pointed out to him that I had chosen this priest caricature. And there was a lot of real positive things. Everybody was happy, you know, and I felt like people were responding to me in a positive way. And that stayed with me through grade school. And I never seriously considered it a different endeavor. It was also in my family, holidays when we would visit an aunt and an uncle's home and there would be other relatives, I noticed that people were supportive of that choice. And I come from an Irish Catholic background, and clergy, it was seen to be a privilege to have a priest in the family. So it kind of became my mission to be this cleric so they could feel good about themselves. And I certainly felt good because it was the only place I felt like I was getting... I wasn't confusing it with love, but with some kind of respect. I was being treated with a level of respect that I didn't normally enjoy.
Yes, you were saying about, you know, your ways of coping with your father's violence, you know, with the breaking of the toys. Your sexual abuse, how was that affecting you, do you think? You were saying it wasn't parental, it was out of the family.
It was a babysitter. It was something that I was not even aware of until probably 1987. And so that would be 4 years ago. I had just totally suppressed it to the point I didn't even know it was there. But certainly on an unconscious level, it would have been another link in the chain of evidence that I was defective or deficient or flawed. Another aspect to this that is another thing that I'm kind of active in right at the moment is trying to get the Roman Catholic Church to change their liturgy. And since certainly, I don't know how long back, but, you know, many decades, the liturgy has included a prayer that is a metaphor out of the New Testament. And it's, Lord, I am not worthy to receive you, say the word, and my soul shall be healed. And that metaphor comes from the centurion who stops Jesus, and I think it's his daughter at home who's sick, and Jesus says, I will come and cure her because of his faith. And he said, Lord, I'm not worthy to receive you in my home. Just say the word. And the importance of that is that it's the first biblical example of a person being healed without Christ's physical presence. And so for us, it's supposed to represent hope that we don't have to physically be in the presence of God in a real tangible physical sense for miracles and good things. The problem with this kind of language, though, I think, is that, you know, if we want to be honest and admit that 10 to 35% of our children are abused in some pretty serious ways and that we're really all abused, for some of us, the church takes on the persona of God and priests and nuns and authority figures. I attended a Catholic school, so for 9 months a year, 6 days a week, I would go to church. And in the old liturgy, we would say it three times, Domine non sum dignus. And it was another very serious manifestation of my personal unworthiness, just more supporting that I'm not worthy, I'm not worthy, I'm not worthy. And I think that this is an awful message for children to hear. And given all of the good reasons for it, the metaphor, etc., I think that they don't outweigh the damage that some, and maybe statistically not many, but still some very important individuals, because we don't need to be harming people through our worship. And somehow, I'm bright and sensitive, so I have the ability of picking out all of these negative kinds of things and embracing them, you see. So high school, I went into the seminary. I spent 3 years there. And the first year, I loved it. Second year, I didn't enjoy it so much. I think as a result of the violence as a child, I have issues with authority, and I simply do not like to be told what to do to this day. I just don't like it, and I feel some emotions when I'm dictated to. I can extend that to even myself telling me what to do. And I was a heavy smoker for 25 years, and on a conscious level, I knew smoking was unhealthy, I knew it was bad, and I shouldn't be doing it. And I tried different ways to quit. And initially, they were old promises, and like, I'll never do this again, you see. And I set myself up into this conflict where it became increasingly more difficult for me to not smoke. And I was ultimately able to quit by not quitting, but rather I decided that I can always smoke. The next time I had finished a carton of cigarettes and made the conscious decision to not go to the store and buy another carton, and that the next time I wanted to smoke a cigarette, I could choose to smoke or not. And the only stipulation that I put in was that I would spend 1 minute before I exercised that choice, and in that minute I used an affirmation that I was basically saying to myself I was choosing to be healthy. And then if at the end of that minute I wanted to go smoke, I had permission to do so. So I wasn't butting up against those issues of authority, and for me it worked. I mean, it's like games we play with ourselves, but yet pretty clearly there's reasons for all of this in my past. And so it's been a challenge for me to learn how to work with the psychological baggage, I guess, that I've developed and carried, and how to understand why I do what I do, and couched in terms of a more realistic interpretation of myself. You know, many of us do things and we don't understand quite why we did them. We regret it, we wish we hadn't, and yet we'll do it again. And I think, and yet we're afraid to even admit that we are doing things. I mean, that feels crazy. But that's our unconscious at work. And I think our unconscious is our best friend in many ways. Seemingly bizarre behaviors that people engage in often, if you can work with it, you'll find that there's some really deep, strong-seated motivations, and that while it's easy to judge them as bad or crazy or evil, you start to work through that and you can find that there's some benefits that they're getting out of it, even though it appears to be self-destructive. And so I guess maybe for me, trying to not judge people out of stereotypes, but rather trying to not forget that we do what we do for reasons, and that sometimes we may not know those reasons, but they're real and valid. And trying to be accepting of other humans, whether I agree with them or not, is pretty irrelevant. And to be respectful to them. I think, oh, a different, this is profound. I can tell by the way I reacted to this glimmer. The summer before I started the fifth grade, I remember sitting in my home on the couch, and we had a dog. Dog's name was Duchess, and a cute, great little dog. And my father came home from work. Now, my father didn't always come home from work. He was a man who drank excessively and caroused. He was a man who made a lot of money but brought very little of it home. And my mother, in fact, had to go to work to provide us with food and clothes. I remember in 1948, he made as much money as I hoped to someday make in 1962, you see. So he made a lot, because that money translated through several inflationary periods. And yet we didn't have a lot. And although I felt or believed I deserved to be treated badly, I didn't like it, and I guess there was some loose ends there. I didn't like how it was and how it felt, and somehow I didn't like how he behaved, but I didn't, I wasn't able to make it his fault. You know, it was my fault, and I owned it as, and in fact, the condition of my parents' marriage, I thought, was also a response to my defectiveness. So on this evening, my father came home, and our dog, Duchess, was always excited when he came home, and just really pleased and happy and excited, and, you know, shaking the tail and just really running around. And I remember sitting there, and he was walking up the steps, and I thought, you know, it's really unfair that this dog has all these warm, good feelings for this guy because he's a bum. And he came in, and he knelt down, and he started playing with the dog, got her leash, took her for a walk, and I thought, well, he's nice to her. And something inside of me, I realized that every human deserves to be treated with at least the respect that we treat our animals. And that was the difference, is that I wasn't treated as nicely as the dog. But I knew somehow at that moment that I was entitled to that. And it kind of shifted away where it started to become his problem rather than my problem, you see. And because I could see the dog was responding in its own reality, in its relationship with him, and that, you know, he was good to the dog. And he truly was. He just had trouble with human beings, you know. And he was raised in an abusive family, and there was a lot of alcoholism and violence. And, you know, I can understand his behaviors as, you know, the manifestation of a very tormented person just a deep core of rage. Drinking would be, and sometimes a way of anesthetizing some of the feelings. He didn't deal with feelings. He had them, but he couldn't deal with them in a healthy way, and so he would hit, be gruff, put people off, couldn't show affection, use people. He needed, in his own way, to dominate, manipulate, control people. That seemed to be how he was able to measure his worth, is getting people to do what he wanted. And so he was a salesman, and he was successful. He needed, I think, I was never directly involved, but I think he needed a lot of sexual conquests to prove his virility and, again, his worth as a man. And I'm, you know, I don't know where that comes from for him. And he's been dead since 1983. And at this point, I don't particularly care where it comes from for him. I know that when he died, I felt a lot of grief, and I have come to realize that the death of my father represented the impossibility of having a father. That as long as he was alive, there would be a possibility of cultivating a relationship. Not much of a possibility, but it existed. And so I think that when he died, there was a kind of a sense of abandonment that I'll never have a father. I was sired biologically, but I wasn't raised by a loving paternal man. Somehow, I don't know if it's instinct or socialization or what, but I needed to be, and the absence of that was important. But, and in my presentations, I often make the point that all of us deserve to be treated with respect and with dignity, and we deserve to be loved. And we don't all get it, and we can't do anything about it other than respond. And it's important to look around and see that there are a lot of monsters out there. And these monsters have children, and these children look up to these monsters, etc., and the children are abused. And outside looking in, we can see that the parents don't deserve the love and respect of the child, and the child doesn't deserve the abuse. And if we can own our entitlement to the love that we didn't get, and that it's not my fault, this person, and we can be, you know, have compassion, this person wasn't capable of giving it, etc., but that doesn't diminish or subordinate our need for the love that we didn't get. And so I've not really been able to have any real fond feelings for this man. I've never visited the grave, and I doubt that I ever will, and it's an indifference. And I feel pretty good about that, because I don't hate him, and I don't have a lot of negative feelings towards him, and certainly he invited those kinds of feelings. But I think given the context of his life and his interactions, I mean, he did what he did because he didn't know any better. You know, that's not to say he couldn't have done better or that he should have done what he did. But I don't see him as this malevolent, evil human being. He just, this is how he reacted to people, and it was bad and he shouldn't have, but it's where he is, and I don't have to deal with him anymore. And I'm pleased about that. I don't miss him. And I'm glad that he's not here, and I'm glad I don't have to deal with him. And to me, that doesn't feel negative or vicious or vindictive. It feels healthy. It's like there's a part of me, I can't control these people. I can't make them be what I want them to be. And if they're negatively impacting my life, then I feel like I have the right to sever them. You know, we amputate unhealthy limbs to save the rest, and I feel that that's kind of a, so much, I don't know how far you want me to go, but my childhood has been.
Yes, it's interesting, you know, you were saying about how this made the issue of your rejection of authority, even the authority within your personality.
Oh, absolutely.
Then why on earth did you go in the army, you know, when your heart came up?
Why did I go? I was drafted, and
but was this normal then for young men at
oh,
that
yes,
time?
Oh, yes, yes.
Could you tell me about this?
Sure. I guess, I don't know when the draft began. You know, we had the draft during World War II and conscripted, you know, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of young men sent them Europe in the Asian theater. The Korean War, it seems to me, I was born in 1945. So I was young when the Korean War. I remember reserve units were sent to serve in Korea, and I don't recall if we also conscripted or not. I just don't remember. I would guess that the draft became instituted about maybe 1965, 1966 in this country. We didn't have a lottery then. I belonged to a selective service board, and it was 112. That's one of the numbers I'll never. The third Thursday of the month, the notices from the government that you were drafted arrived at the home. And so I noticed that I would live from the third Thursday of a month to the third Thursday. And each time it didn't show up, there was a reprieve. When I finished high school, I graduated in 1963, and I went to night school. I worked. So I was working my way through school. And so in 1964, I was, I think, taking four classes in college, which in here was 12 hours. And I had a student deferment. As the war went on, they started making, I think he only needed to take 9 hours at the time, but they started to increase the requirements. And so I was actually taking 12 hours a semester for two semesters and 6 hours in summer school, so I was taking the full 30 hours, which is what an ordinary load for a student would be. But the requirements went that they didn't give student deferments out for a number less than 14, and it became physically impossible to take that many. And part of my motivation for taking such a heavy load was to not go in the service. There was a war, people were getting killed. There was a lot of controversy. I remember the presidential election, 1964, Barry Goldwater ran against Lyndon Johnson. And it was the first election that I was personally interested in. The war was a central issue. I was about 18. It became clear to me that whoever got elected was going to have a pretty big impact on my fate. Barry Goldwater's position is, if you're going to fight a war, you fight it, you win it, you get out. And I remember to this day Lyndon Johnson saying, "We will never commit our American boys to Vietnam." And I can just see it, I hear it over and over. I mean, that was a fundamental plank in his platform. Jumping a few years later, Nixon and the Watergate, which was a scandal that the Republican Party breaking into the Democratic National Headquarters and stealing sensitive information, etc. Just prior to Watergate, days before, Daniel Ellsberg, an investigative reporter, broke in and got some files from, I don't even remember all the details, but what I do remember was the information was very specifically that while Johnson was campaigning that we will not commit American troops on a large scale, he and his cabinet were planning the B-52 bombing raids into Vietnam. And I've always felt that the biggest tragedy around Watergate is it swept that story out of the newspapers, and that we, as a nation, have maintained our denial about the evilness of what Vietnam was about and have been unwilling to look at it. And probably we'll continue that for another generation until we become more distant. I was a night student, but a student, and I lived in this country. I was confused by the student element, full-time students on the two coasts, California, Ivy League colleges, the protests against the war. And it seemed, it was difficult for me to believe that these students had such a clear insight into the propriety of the war, and all of the rest of us didn't. And so my interpretation of the anti-war demonstrations and the burning of flags and the ROTC building here in St. Louis was that they were self-serving, that they didn't want to serve, they didn't want to go in the army, and by trying to foment and discredit the war, it was a way of avoiding the war. And again, I don't know if I can convey how inculcated being an American in our culture that meant being good, but as from the time of infancy, I knew, and it was reinforced over and over and over in millions of ways, that Americans fought on the side of right. We picked our wars, we fought for right, and we won. And if there was a war, and if there was a right, we would be there. And it was like we were the white knights of Camelot. You know, we could come and save. So, part of my emotion right now has to do with a couple of things.